Happy Monday and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. A reminder starting off the week that you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. And also, this would be a good time, Jim, to pitch our newsletters as well. If you have not subscribed to one of the Bulwark newsletters, it is easy. It is cheap. In fact, it's so cheap, it's actually free.
No, it's not even free. It's three for the price of one.
That is absolutely true. You know, you can start your morning with Morning Shots, which I write. JVL has one in the middle of the day. And then Jim Swift comes in and wraps up all of the day's events and the stuff that's on the Bulwark. And so you get three for the price of nothing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One equals zero, right?
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Three equals one equals zero.
Yeah. So if you did subscribe to my podcast, my newsletter this morning, you got the utter mindlessness of Sean Hannity, Trump's greatest deal ever, Hugh Hewitt does not disappoint, Biden doesn't hold the line, and some thoughts on David French's thoughts. And by the way, do you guys hate typos as much as I hate typos? I hate them, especially when they're mine.
It's even worse in newsletters because there's nothing you can do once you've clicked send.
Yeah. That's the big problem. The last bastion of sort of web media where it's not everything is just completely fixable instantaneously. It's sort of
typos are forever.
It is
newsletters.
It is forever, and also I don't have the luxury of being able to blame anybody else for it. Not that I actually would have, but you know, I pointed out we'll get to this a little bit later. The president's great Mexico trade deal, which turns out to be not necessarily as great. It was the kind of the blink. We'll get to all of that, but. You know, I pointed out that, you know, Trump gets away with this sort of stuff, you know, the threats and the all caps tweets, because he knows that he can always rely on what Jonah Goldberg, you know, called the compulsive turd polishers out there, you know, and, you know, obviously there's, you know, American Greatness and, you know, Breitbart and Fox News and all of those. But then I tried to make a point about Hugh Hewitt and it being a more genteel turd polisher. But I blew it. Okay, so there's my line, you know, Hugh Hewitt, genteel turd polisher, and what I actually typed or auto-corrected to, I don't know. See, I'm already trying to blame it on something, was Gentile polishers. Someone from Gentile.
I really hoped that was going to be where you were going. That's too bad, I'm sorry, but also kind of nice.
There's nothing Gentile about it. It's genteel.
Right.
So,
well, you know who's going to have a field day with that is Paul Mellon if he reads about it.
Well, I'm highlighting it right now. Okay, so before we get into all of this though, you guys caught the Axios on HBO last night. Where Jonathan Swain is like, he's on a roll here. You know, there was a rap on him that he was kind of an Access reporter for a while. And he is, you want to talk about a guy who's turning around his reputation for being a deadly interviewer. In any case, he sat down with, I was going to say a disheveled looking Steve Bannon, but that's redundant, right?
Right. You repeat yourself. Yes.
I definitely repeat myself. And he's asking about, so basically kind of like, what are you up to, Steve Bannon? You had this great plan for moving to Europe and being the great Rasputin of the populist right in Europe. And it really hasn't worked out. And we might as well just play this. This is sort of about a minute and a half exchange where Jonathan Swain, in his very sort of low-key way, kind of dismantles Steve Bannon. Here it is.
I want to talk to you about something that you told the New York Times. Yep. You said you would offer populist parties across Europe,
yep,
the quote, fundamental building blocks for winning, including, yep, expertise in polling,
yep,
data analytics,
yep,
messaging and get out the vote,
yep,
efforts, along with the development of media, yep, surrogates, campaign war rooms,
yep,
rapid response.
Yep.
Quite a plan you had there. Have you executed it?
We got our lawyers involved, and with election laws in Europe, I'm not so sure that we can actually provide that.
How many campaign war rooms did you set up?
We had our overall war room, but we were told we couldn't do the war rooms either.
Sounds like you haven't done anything.
No, that's absolutely not true. If you go back and talk to the individual parties, we've done tremendous...
Who should we talk to? What do you think Salvini would say?
I think Salvini said, hey, these guys are solid guys, and they've given us a lot of overall advice.
So we spoke to Salvini.
Yep.
Salvini said he's spoken to you twice in his,
yep,
life. Barely knows you.
Well, I mean... Is that true
with Salvini? He said he's only spoken to you twice ever.
I think maybe three or four times. We've talked to Salvini three or four times.
I think a cynic might say, okay, Steve Bannon, Trump purged him from American politics, cut him off at the legs, and now he's taking his show to a monastery. He's hanging out in the monastery trying to get crowds in Europe. I mean, is this just because you don't have relevance in American politics?
By the way, I think I have a lot of relevance.
Okay, so wait, guys, make up that. Basically, sitting there and, you know, is there something about the British/Australian media that's just better about these kinds of interviews, because do American interviewers just have sort of a restraint that I don't want to actually destroy you like this?
Or they don't do the research a lot of the time. I remember there was one time there was a congressman from the South who was on a show, and it's just like, oh, the reporter goes, oh, do you have a degree in economics? And he goes, actually, I do, from Duke.
Oh, you know, I remember that.
That's the American media. You know, I think the kind of British or Australian version is they did do the research, and you saw that when he was like, oh, you know, if you talk to Matteo Salvini, you know, he'll tell you this, and he goes, coincidence you bring that up. We did talk to him. And then just to see the unflappable kind of look, that's the true mark of an amazingly good bullshitter, is that a lot of times when people lie and they immediately get caught in the lie, they panic and they're like, oh shit, you caught me. Bannon, well, you know, then he just kind of pivots to his next lie.
I think we talked three or four times. That was really good. The one thing I wanted to say about Swan specifically is just that I think the point you just made, Jim, is correct. But the thing that really strikes me whenever I see these video segments, and I don't know why these people keep going on video with Jonathan Swan, because he's skewering them every time. But so often when you see sort of like the standards of sort of TV reportage, the Jim Acostas of the world or whoever, it's this very sort of self-serious, like furrowed brow kind of energy that's coming off of them. A lot of like, oh, well, did you really say, you know, come on, sir, can you really possibly? Whereas with Swan, I mean, he's just sort of, he's chipper. He's kind of, he comes across as very friendly and kind of just affable as he is asking these, you know, really, really pointed questions that really nail these guys to the wall. And I think it's sort of the interplay of those two things that works so well in these sort of
interviews. In every interview he does, there's like a Chris Hansen to catch a predator moment where, you know, you think, oh, it's going well, but you kind of know what's going to happen. Then he goes, you know, Steve Bannon, please sit down. And that's why HBO makes great television with Axios.
Well, I think one of the reasons why people keep sitting down with him is this is kind of a new thing. And people haven't figured out that Jonathan Swan is like a barracuda.
Yeah, it's like the Sacha Baron Cohen problem, right? It's like you can only do the Ali G thing or the Borat thing like so many times before you become notorious enough for it that people sort of put their guard back up. But in the meantime, it's unbelievably good TV.
Well, it is, and you know, I'm going back to, you know, thinking about what he does differently, and I think you're right, Jim, that he actually does the research, because I think the norm on American television is that somebody asks a question, somebody evades it, or they filibuster, and there's sort of somebody goes through the motion of continuing the question, but the clock is running, and so they get away with it. So filibustering and evading questions actually works. Yeah. However, in this format, it doesn't. And so Swan, when he was talking with Jared Kushner, kept asking the question over and over and over again. Is it racist? Is it racist? Is it racist? And Jared Kushner had his one line, well, I wasn't there, and he wasn't letting him get away with it. And then when he looks at his phone and says, well, we talked to Salvini, and he doesn't know you. I mean, isn't this something, the flashback to high school, the guy that said, yeah, I go out with so-and-so, you know, the cheerleader. Yeah, you know, well, we just talked to her, and she's never met you. You know, it had that kind of vibe. Okay, let's move on to something a little bit more serious. Joe Biden, and there's no other way to describe this, is there, other than flip-flopped on the issue of the Hyde Amendment, which is the federal ban on the taxpayer funding of abortions, and he's flipped back and forth all the time. And Andrew, by the way, have I actually introduced our guest today? Andrew Egger, who is the senior writer for The Bulwark, and Jim Swift, senior editor of The Bulwark and the producer of this podcast. So, hey, good morning.
Hello. Hey, yeah, I mean, two men who honestly need no introduction. Well,
see, that was what I was thinking in the back of my mind. Okay, so Andrew, you pointed out before the flip-flop that this whole issue really does highlight the problem that Joe Biden has. And it's pretty dramatically on display. You know, he's still number one in the polls, but this new Des Moines Register poll is out showing that it's not that solid. He certainly doesn't have, you know, Hillary Clinton frontrunner status going into this. But also, the big question was, was Joe Biden going to be able to hold the line against the pressure from his own party to move left? And in the first really big test, I would say he failed. So talk to me about this the flip flop on the Hyde Amendment and what it means.
Yeah. And well, you say that I wrote my piece before, you know, the big flip flop, which is true, but it was also, you know, already after one iteration of flip flopping from Biden on this specific issue. We don't even have really a word to describe what he's done over the past month now.
Yeah, the pre flip flop.
Yeah, exactly. Where just a month ago or so, he signaled that he now, after a whole career of being for the Hyde Amendment, was against it. A few weeks go by and he says that he was actually mischaracterized in those remarks, and he was actually thinking of a completely different policy, and he was still for the Hyde Amendment. There's a big backlash to that. And then it's about a day later that he comes out again and says, actually, I changed my mind. Now I'm against the Hyde Amendment. And you're exactly right. I mean, the problem here is that that he's trying to carve out this lane as a moderate for himself, but he doesn't really know what that means. He doesn't really know what specific things he can, you know, nail down as being in that moderate lane without getting all the time crucified by the progressives. And I think one interesting point that the Washington Post Dave Weigel has been making, I hope I pronounced Weigel correctly, yeah, has been making a lot about Biden is Biden has benefited very, very much in the early going from people who see themselves as strategic voters, people who see themselves as wanting Donald Trump out of office at all costs, and thinking that Biden, because, you know, they see him as the moderate, is going to be the guy who's best suited to go in and do that. So it's this very preliminary sort of strategic choice, like, oh, who's the guy who I think is going to be best at beating Trump? Maybe this guy who appeals to some of the same kind of people Trump do, Joe Biden. And there's something obviously to that kind of thinking. I mean, Trump himself obviously sees Biden as a relatively formidable challenger. He's the guy he's been going after most consistently over the past couple of weeks. That's the tell. But this is the problem, obviously, that moderate style Democrats run into now, is that it's one thing to want to capture the moderate lane, and it's another thing to feel your way toward what that actually means in terms of policies you embrace and political practice and things like that. And that's the problem Hillary Clinton had in 2016, is that what that ended up boiling down to oftentimes for her was just sort of gesturing in the direction that some mystical sort of theoretical center left Democrat would like, you know, whether that's just basically saying, oh, I'm pro-capitalism, I like capitalism, I think socialism's a bridge too far, while then still, you know, supporting pretty much every socially left policy that you can name, and sort of trying to portray them as just sort of like centrist and all these ways, and basically just coming across as just really focus tested and really really buyable and really sort of afraid of their own voters and things like that. And that's going to be the same problem that Biden faces. Obviously, he's a much more gifted politician than Hillary Clinton was. We've seen that over and over again.
We'll see.
Well, yeah, I mean, and he has his downsides, right? But they work, the gaffes and things work for him in a way, just because it's sort of his brand. You can talk about sexism and things like that, and maybe there are points to be made here. But he's made it this far, you know, as much on the back of his gaffes as anything else. But yeah, I think we're going to see him continue to struggle in these ways because he cannot articulate a reason for why he opposes the Hyde Amendment now, as opposed to a lot of these other people where that's just where they're at, you know?
Yeah. I mean, well, let me read you what Matt Lewis wrote over in the Daily Beast. You know, he says that this flip-flop, you know, clearly demonstrates the Democratic Party is not a viable option for social conservatives who take their faith seriously enough to be morally offended by Donald Trump's toxic rhetoric and uncompassionate conservatism. Even if a candidate were to declare a truce on social issues, the Democratic interest group, in this case feminists, are too powerful within the coalition to deny. The Hyde Amendment protected people who deeply oppose abortion from being compelled to bankroll it via their tax dollars. If Joe Biden can no longer support that, what should we expect from the more liberal judges he'd be nominating, the bureaucrats he will be appointing? So he basically argues, you know, this kind of closes that one more door for anti-Trump social conservatives, that they were willing to accept the ceasefire on this issue, and it makes it that much harder. Jim Swift?
The bigger issue for Biden and this gaffe here is not just the Trump skeptic or anti-Trump you know, social conservatives who would be willing to view Biden as the least bad, especially compared to, you know, everyone to his far left on abortion. I mean, he's now signaled that he's with them. But this really puts blood in the water. I mean, Biden has kind of been playing this inevitability game. I'm not going to go to the California, convention. I'm not going to, do this town hall online. I'm just going to do my events and, let Biden be Biden. And I remember, I think back to 2016, and I've worked on campaigns, Trump supporters would show up at the events of other people that weren't Trump to troll them. If I'm a Democratic opponent, I wouldn't send like a Mayor Pete supporter, wearing Mayor Pete gear to troll Biden. I would, start picking people who aren't readily identifiable surrogates for my campaign, who I know are smart, policy-oriented people, and start giving them very specific questions to ask Joe Biden that he's willing to flip-flop on, because Biden has this, a politician's knack for saying things that the person in the rope line wants to hear.
Right. And so this is a tell, yeah.
And you could easily just start cutting him more and more and, losing coalitions. I mean, the Hyde Amendment it's not a huge coalition. People who are pro-life think the Hyde Amendment's great because not only are they against abortion, rightly so, they're against taxpayer funding of it. But, you could start carving off all these other things with strategic gaffes. And, I guess that's my free unsolicited advice.
Let me read you an email that I got from one of our listeners who was responding to Matt Lewis's column, which I included in my newsletter. Matt Lewis arguing that, that this obviously is disqualifying for social conservatives. He writes, this guy named Howard, Matt Lewis has it backwards. It's not that social conservatives cannot trust moderate Democrats. It's that social conservatives have undermined the compromise, I would use the word ceasefire, underlying the Hyde Amendment. The Hyde Amendment permitted social conservatives to avoid participating in providing abortions through their taxes at a time when abortion was generally available throughout the U.S. However, social conservatives were not satisfied with the compromise and have made abortion practically unavailable in many states. With the attack on the availability of abortion, why would moderate Democrats support the compromise made in the Hyde Amendment? It takes two to tango, and it's clear that social conservatives prefer to dance alone. And this strikes me as another example of kind of the spiral that as each side moves toward its fringes, it makes compromise that much less palatable. So any response to that, there was a ceasefire over the Hyde Amendment, but when the pro-life movement decided it wanted to, wipe out access to abortion and ban abortion, that marked the end of the ceasefire.
So I don't think that that's necessarily an unreasonable take. I can see where Howard is coming from. Howard, thanks for reading the Bulwark. And not to dump on our readers. In my own mind, the ceasefire as posited is not, we'll get the Hyde Amendment in exchange for, not trying to continue to restrict abortion or something like that. I mean, it seems to me that the Hyde Amendment is the compromise sort of on its own terms. It's like, it is itself, an exception to a rule. It's an exception that abortion remains legal, but, taxpayer dollars of people who think it's an unspeakable crime, are not going to protect it. And so this is sort of the Biden line, right? I mean, right. this is Biden's own case for why he should be, not dragged through the mud for this flip-flop, because he's basically saying, well, I can no longer support the Hyde Amendment at a time when abortion is being, waged war against across the country. But I just for those reasons, I mean, I see that as more of a transparently political move from Biden.
There is a tit for tat aspect to this, and Niles Rosenquist has a great item on that on our site today. You should read.
Very good. Yeah.
And I shared a piece today, written somewhere else, about the Hyde Amendment and how in the short term it's not really going anywhere. And someone who follows me on Twitter, whose name I don't recall, says, well, people on the left who support abortion see what goes on in Georgia and Alabama, and they view that as an escalation. So why should they not escalate? And, they want taxpayer funding of all healthcare. And if abortion is healthcare, is healthcare is a right and abortion is a right, they're going to say, well, why not?
Yeah, I think that what you're just getting at, Jim, is like really a crucial point here, because one thing that has not really been dug into quite as much is part of the reason why the Hyde Amendment going out the window has become such a party line thing for the Democrats is not only because they've sort of continued to move left on the specific issue of abortion, but it also has to do a lot with what you're getting into now with the way that they have really come around on the idea of nationalized healthcare, right? Medicare for all and repeal of the Hyde Amendment are logically, you know, coherent. They're two sides of the same coin, essentially, because if the federal government is going to take over the vast majority of healthcare in America, then the Hyde Amendment becomes an increasingly onerous piece of legislation, right? So in that sense, it's almost, you know, from a pro-life perspective, worse to see a guy like Biden coming out on this rather than just sort of, you know, you expect it from Medicare for all people, but it's so clearly just sort of pandering and trying to get people off his back when it's a Catholic guy like Biden doing
it. Well, and the average voter doesn't know about the Hyde Amendment. I mean, they don't. I mean, this goes to the fact that the Planned Parenthood, like the NRA on the right, has kind of become the id of the Democratic Party. Now it's abortion, everything, and everyone has to, you know, satisfy and scratch that itch. But, you know, most voters couldn't tell you what the Hyde Amendment was, its history, or what it's about.
The most engaged, the people who are driving this debate, they know. They know what it's about.
And it's an important touchstone, right?
Yeah, and Matt is right that it's going to make it, you know, much, much, much harder for a certain class of voter to go along. Let's switch to where we're at here on the tariff wars. And since it's like midday on Monday, we're sort of in the middle of between two tariff wars. Good news is we're not going to have tariffs on Mexico, at least for now. Bad news is the president is once again threatening new tariffs on China. Well, let's talk about over the weekend. The president and his supporters claiming that, see, the threat of tariffs worked because Mexico did all these things. And then, of course, you have this story in the New York Times that the deal, you know, announced with great fanfare, consists largely of actions that Mexico had already promised to take in prior discussions with the United States. Over the last several months, according to officials from both countries, it was unclear whether Mr. Trump believed the agreement truly represented new and broader concessions, or whether the president understood the limits of the deal, but accepted it as a face-saving way to escape the political and economic consequences. Blah, blah, blah. So where are we at here? On the Mexico trade deal, because people are looking around going, okay, exactly what did we get for all of that? I mean, again, you know, the president's actually pretty good at this. You know, he basically lights a fire, right? Runs around, says there's fire, fire, fire. Then he puts out the fire, and then he claims that he's a fireman hero, right? I mean, he's an arsonist who wants to be a hero firefighter.
I think this is a warning against triumphalism. A lot of people out there, like, you know, we mentioned Hugh Hewitt earlier, and this is, I think, one of the perils of having a weekly column, decided for the next day, make his weekly column like, oh, critics of the president are just so confused and confounded by this huge win, when we didn't even know exactly what was in it. And then when we did find out what was in it, it was basically kind of a big nothing burger. And then, you know, with some other things, TK, I mean, these, you know, important things that the president, you know, saying that Mexico has immediately agreed to buy large quantities of agricultural product from our great patriot farmers. One, under NAFTA, there's basically no tariffs between the U.S. and Mexico and ag products. And Mexico is not a centrally planned economy. I mean, everyone might have this idea of what they think Mexico is because they watch Narcos and, you know, yeah, Mexico's corrupt and whatnot, but it's a free market economy. The government doesn't – our government is less of a free market economy than Mexico when it comes to ag. I mean, buying all these corn and soybeans and all this other sort of stuff.
You mean there's not a central office where somebody decides how many avocados will we sell to the gringos this week?
In the U.S., we have these different boards. I mean, do you remember the California Raisins ad?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was like a protectionist raisin board. I mean, these things all date back to World War II. I mean, milk. But there's really no way Mexico as a country can agree to buy more of something. Really, the only way that experts on the agronomy, so to speak, predicted that Mexico could come up with a way to find a way as a government to leverage the increase, other than like subsidizing it, and they would never subsidize American corn, that'd be stupid, is to mandate an increase in biofuels.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
then that would have the effect of needing more corn. But other than that, you know, Mexico isn't going around and telling people how much, you know, what their milk market quota is and all this other stuff, which is something the United States actually does. We're surprisingly unfree market in that regard.
Yeah. So I have to go back and quote Peter Baker again from the New York Times, though. You know, we've all heard Trump supporters say, well, they like the fact that he fights. And what Baker wrote over the weekend was actually the key to this administration is he threatens. He threatens a lot. You know, I mean, remember when he first came into office, he threatened to impose a huge tax on all goods coming from, China. And then he retreats, you know, in the face of opposition. He makes lots of threats he doesn't follow through on. He threatens to sue adversaries. He threatens to, you know, rewrite libel laws. He threatens to take away a license from NBC, to eliminate a tax break for the NFL, to withdraw troops from South Korea. Lots and lots and lots of threats. That don't actually end up with anything. So we're on the continuum. Do you put this, Andrew Agger? Because, I mean, for the average person, it's like, well, you know, I mean, look, Hugh Hewitt says this is like the greatest victory, you know, in the history of American diplomacy. And other folks, the other, you know, critics are basically saying, yeah, he blinked. So where's the truth here?
Well, I definitely think that there's cause for concern that the president is reaching more and more sort of frequently and even sort of impulsively for this particular weapon, right? I mean, it took him a long time, sort of hard to think back on it now, but it took him a long time for him to actually sort of work up to starting his first trade war about a year after he came into office, with finally sort of ramping things up with China and
then
the European Union and stuff.
Gone.
Right. Yeah. And you know, they were very impactful and important actions. I mean, they were important. Yeah, they were impactful. But they were also sort of relatively clearly delineated. I mean, they were issued under specific statutory authority, as all presidential trade actions have to be, in ways that were maybe like a little bit fudging here and there, but were, you know, at least legally defensible. And now, you know, more and more frequently, we're seeing him, and as you might expect for a president who thinks that tariffs are just sort of a positive economic good and only suckers don't use them, he's just reaching for it again and again and again to try to get leverage with foreign countries on a whole host of different issues. So this latest thing with Mexico, it had nothing really to do with any particular trade action. He was just going to slap tariffs on them until they fixed illegal immigration. Now, over the weekend, we hear news that President Trump is threatening to slap new tariffs on China if the Chinese president doesn't meet with him at the G20 conference that's coming up.
That'll be another huge win, right?
When he does meet with him, when the sun comes up in the morning. And yes, right.
Side note about Hewitt and his column and all
okay,
this.
Genteel turd publisher, not Gentile.
Yeah, I
reviewed his book for the Standard. And incidentally, the title of my article became the title of his paperback version, and I got no thanks for that. Hugh Hewitt's Little Red Book. But basically, he argued back at the time, the key to Republicans dealing with Trump is to basically suck up to him and offer him victories. Mm-hmm. And just, even if it was like a stupid victory,
right,
just give him victory after victory after victory. And, you know, Republicans are hypocritical on all of this because, I mean, they have been kind of pushing back on trade, which is good, while defending all of this indefensible stuff. Hugh, I think, is just following his own advice, which was, this is great. Keep going. Keep
getting
the big
wins. I think another crucial thing is that other countries are beginning to take Hugh Hewitt's own advice about Trump, right?
Well, they are. That's what Paul Krugman says. It's heartbreaking. One of the worst people you know just made a great point.
You're about to quote him, aren't you?
Yeah, in The Heroes of the Great Patriotic Trade War. And he talks about, in the case of the Mexican standoff, this may not seem too bad, but think about what it means when foreign leaders know that the president of the United States is gullible, easily susceptible to flattery, and eager to proclaim victory and unwilling to admit that he didn't actually get anything significant. I mean, that's showing your hand. And I'm old enough to remember when Republicans were arguing for tax reform because the uncertainty of taxes was bad for business. What do you call constant trade wars and threats of tariffs other than just creating tons of uncertainty? And, you know, that is absent from a huge aspect of this debate, is every time the president of the United States threatens, whether it's a specific country, whether it's Canada, one of our biggest trading partners, Mexico or China, all these people in risk management and in supply chains, you know, they're crapping their pants.
You know, this is a very good point, Jim. You're not just another pretty face here, even though we're just doing a podcast, because I certainly remember back in 2009 and 2010, during the, you know, the go-go days of the Obama administration, this whole point about the unpredictability for the markets and how dangerous this was, that there was no sense of certainty, that you had, you know, government, you know, changing its policies. This was a big theme in conservative circles and among Republicans. Well, the other thing that I think, and you know, Trump has figured this out, is that he can use these tariffs because he can. He has so much power. Mm-hmm. It is a mm-hmm. weapon that he has virtually without check, and he's figured out that despite all the threats that he's getting from Republicans in Congress, that they're not going to do anything about it. And, you know, I continue to find it amazing that the president of the United States has the unilateral power to impose tens of billions of dollars in taxes on Americans without any legislative action whatsoever, and that Congress really is so supine that it just rolls over. I mean, you know, in what understanding of our constitutional order can the president, impose a tax without having a vote in the House of Representatives, without the Senate having any say whatsoever? Now, having said that, two things did happen before this quote-unquote big deal was announced. Number one, there was some talk, and I didn't take it all that seriously, that Republicans were finally going to push back on this issue, and that there was some suggestion that, hey, maybe we will have enough to override a veto. And then, of course, you had those relatively poor jobs numbers on Friday, which got people to think, whoa, okay, so the uncertainty over a trade war is already slowing down the economy. So you had the political pressure, you had the market pressure, and then the president appears to blink over the weekend. So there's certainly that alternative explanation, alternative to the Hugh Hewitt, most brilliant diplomat in the history of trade wars type thing. But I mean, obviously, so that pressure did work on Trump, didn't it?
Yeah, and just to add one thing about what you're saying about Congress, I do think it's true. I mean, and we've obviously, like you mentioned, we've been down this road before, where Congress, you know, seems to grow a bit of a spine about tariffs for a few days until they realize they can't talk Trump out of it, and then they collapse. I'm right there with you that, you know, perhaps we would have seen that again, but it is worth noting that it from people like McConnell, it did seem like there was perhaps more, you know, more serious opposition percolating for this particular trade action, just because Mexico is such an enormous, enormous trading partner of ours.
When Trump loses to Congress, they can't spin it as, you know, we reasserted ourselves, right?
Right, right, right.
Trump always has to win, even if Congress was the actual winner in something.
Right, right. But what I was gonna try to say is that we talk about the threatening, right? We talk about the uncertainty of him throwing his weight around like this. And I think that's really the key, because the central problem isn't just the actual policies that end up coming out, isn't just the actual trade wars he starts and the actual tariffs he slaps on, although those are really big problems. I mean, the only way to solve the actual the problem of the threats, as opposed to just the problem of the actual trade wars, is not for Congress just to promise to veto this or that individual trade action. It would be for Congress to actually move proactively to pass something, you know, actively restraining the president's tariff-making powers back to something a little bit more like what the founders envisioned when they laid the thing out in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, what else do they have to do? I think there was a Politico story basically saying, you know, the Senate has become the graveyard for legislation. I mean, they do confirm conservative judges, you know, good for them. But other than that, it's like you have created these two, you know, farms for potted plants, and you would think that there would be senators and congressmen who would resent that and go, hey, what are we here for?
And the frustrating thing is that, you know, it isn't as though it would take some great act of, you know, sort of like legislative creativity in order to solve some of these problems. There are already bills, you know, that have been put forward by people like Senator Mike Lee that would go a long way toward addressing some of these very issues when it comes to things like national
emergencies. Or name the bill after Trump.
Yeah, right.
and spin this as a jobs package.
Yeah, right.
You could just throw in some, you know, $5 words. The president will abdicate, you know, these authorities because of his generousness, because he wants the great economy for the American worker and our great patriot farmers. And, you know,
I hope somebody's taking notes here.
Gives up power and, you know, spin it as a win. And, you know, we've seen by Republicans of all stripes and of all levels of intellect that there is a strange ability of people on the right to spin absolute like losses as a big win.
So if you could write that up and we could get that in the hands of a Fox and Friends host and he would read it on the air, we might have solved this constitutional crisis.
Pack it up. Let's go home. We're ready. Mission accomplished. Actually do
that. Okay, I want to take a bizarre right turn, only because Andrew, I follow your Twitter feed, and which, by the way, everyone should do.
This could go all kinds of different ways.
Josh Hawley.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Did you read that piece that he wrote in Christianity Today?
It was interesting. Yeah, it was. I did read it.
You see. So Josh Hawley is the senator from Missouri, Republican senator from Missouri, who's got a great educational background. I mean, he's got a lot of credentials, and he's trying to carve out a position for himself as kind of the new post-Trumpian populist. And he has this this long piece about the Pelagian heresy. Bear with me here, which he basically says governs our politics and our culture today. Is that an unfair summary of it?
That's about right. Essentially saying that the Pelagian view of the human soul is as sort of an agent of unfettered will and just like a pure rational actor who can sort of lift himself up by his bootstraps or descend by his own failings into squalor.
So we're all idiots. Very free good. Will was a bad idea.
God is a cuck with his free will stuff. I'm telling
it's,
you,
it's we're a weird, there. It's a weird, it's a weird way of framing what has been actually a relatively common argument in certain sectors of the right. That and you know you see this some from people like Tucker Carlson. You see this from academics like Patrick Deneen, basically saying pushing back against sort of the libertarian ish. Elements in their Republican Party.
They're bake me a cake, guys, but for tech.
Well, okay, so that's a slightly different issue.
No, but explain the difference between forcing a cake maker to do something and forcing Google to do something. I mean, what right does government have?
Right. So that's Hawley's other big hobby horse is he's an anti-big tech guy. He wants to break up the big tech corporations. He wants to get us all off Facebook and Twitter. That's a little different from what he was getting at in this particular op-ed, which is just sort of pushing back against the notion on the right that, you know, people lift themselves up by their bootstraps and people, you know, fail on their own merits, you know, the sort of that particular flavor right. of Republicanism well, is sort of what he was getting going against there.
So I don't have it in front of me. I wish I could read it a little bit. It strikes me, and I don't know Josh Hawley. I don't have a pre-baked opinion of him, but I've read that, and I know we talked about, he gave the inaugural speech on the floor of the Senate, his maiden speech on the floor of the Senate. And I was talking with James Homan, who writes the Daily 202 for the Washington Post about this, because he devoted a whole newsletter to this. And I was struggling to figure out at the time, so, okay, what was the there with Hawley, that he had this vision, but it was unfettered by any specific policy recommendations? And so I read this whole piece about the Pelagian heresy, etc., so that you don't have to. And I got to tell you, and this may be unfair, and I'm willing to walk it back. You know, it's that he's really working hard to be considered a deep thinker, capital D, capital T, and there's not a lot there. I mean, there's a lot of straining, and there's a lot of, you know, here is the deep learning of going back to the Pelagian heresy to criticize. I'm not sure who he's criticizing. Specifically there, but also it's like, okay, and so how does any single vote or policy that you have recommended line up with anything that you are describing here? So here you have a guy who is reaching for this image of profundity, and I just still do not know where the beef is.
So I'm probably a little bit more pro Hawley than much of the bulwark. Jim and I actually argue about Josh Hawley all the time.
As former Missourian.
Yeah, right. And I you know, I covered his campaign last year for the Weekly Standard, liked him. I will say you're right, I think, Charlie, to get at the fact that, you know, there aren't a whole lot of very concrete policy suggestions coming out of this particular flavor
kind of the bill to ban people, but to ban like the little, you know, bonus boxes in video games.
I think that's just like an unrelated thing, right? I mean, like, he's
saving
that's
people,
also Hawley,
saving
right?
people
I
from
mean,
themselves, you know.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so that's fair to say.
Where
so
your kids' YouTube videos show up.
Let me quote one paragraph from this Holly thing. Perhaps the most eloquent contemporary statement of Pelagian freedom appears in an opinion from the United States Supreme Court in a passage written by former Justice Anthony Kennedy. In 1992, in a case called Casey v. Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania, a famous bugbear case of the pro-life right, he wrote this: "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." And basically what he's saying, which is also, you know, what people like Deneen, people like Chris Arnott are saying, is that this particular concept of utterly deterministic human liberty sounds good in theory, but in practice, what it does is it gives increasing amounts of power to, you know, the people who are set up to succeed in the sort of like the quasi meritocracy that we've set up for ourselves. So it's like it's a relatively, you know, complicated point. I'm personally kind of sympathetic to that point. I'm unfortunately not brushed up on it enough to say a whole lot more intelligently about it than that here. But I think that's sort of what he's trying to get at, is that like for a whole lot of people, they don't see sort of the heart of liberty as being the right to really radically self-define. They see liberty as, you know, the right to be able to sort of pursue the human ends that they see as have been sort of given to them, handed down to them from one sort of tradition or another.
There is a warning here for Holly. Tall, you know, capital D, deep thinking, smart guys who kind of stink at campaigning don't tend to get reelected in Missouri. And if you don't believe me, ask Senator Jim Talent.
I think you guys are being too mean to poor Josh Hawley.
No,
I'll just come out and say it.
We used to live in the show me state.
Yeah, you know? Right.
No, that's completely legitimate. And as I said, I can be, I'm willing to walk back this. You know, I guess my problem was when I opened up the article, the first paragraph I read was, "We stand at one of the great turning points in our national history."
When the
failure of our public philosophy and the crisis of our public life can no longer be ignored, and what we do about these needs will define the era to come.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. He definitely suffers from that sort of like pants too high, sort of Harvard debater.
Yeah.
He can get a little Stentorian. Right.
Because it is easy, but because it is hot.
Earnest sophomore essay.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So yeah,
okay, that's where I'm at here.
Things and bad things, right?
Pants too high, though. See, I wasn't reaching for that. That was good. Okay, anything else you guys think that we need to have our listeners know about? Because I mean, we've covered everything from the defenestration of Steve Bannon to trade laws to Joe Biden to whatever, you know.
I think this was a great episode.
I think we did good, Charlie. I think we can pat ourselves on the back and head home.
Yeah. Well, whether we did good or not, we're still going to pat ourselves on the back and we're going to head home. Andrew Egger and Jim Swift, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Charlie.
Pleasure to be here.
And remember, you can sign up for those free newsletters that get three of them. It's easy. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.